sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The bird flu is back. Employment growth is slowing. Earnings season is upon us, and Amy Smith from Investor's Business Daily is with us today. A lot of information to cover. All that, much, much more on episode number 308 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, Andrew Horowitz here, and it is April 2013, the second week we're approaching earnings season with Alcoa coming out on Monday evening after the close, and there really isn't a lot of anticipation for anything good, which sometimes makes you think about, well, if there's so much negative sentiment when it comes to a company's earnings report, maybe there's too much negativity out there and we'll see some kind of a surprise, at least from the aspect of maybe they will come closer than people believe to a reasonable earnings number, at least the estimate. And that's what everybody's looking for these days, the estimate compared to the actual. And they'll do better, and maybe the stock is hitting a bottom. We've seen some real sell-offs in the materials area lately, and that has some people scratching their head wondering if the global growth story is kind of kaput. What was long considered an indicator of the global strength and the strength in the markets, such as home builders, construction, electronics, infrastructure development, such as copper, has been pretty much been beaten up and thrown out. Coal has been obliterated, although we saw natural gas cap above the $4 level again last week. And that is interesting because we're seeing it now at a reasonably, a 2-year, 3-year high right now. And that bodes well for the coal space. So who knows if companies like, look at Cliffs Natural, which has just fallen off a cliff itself, Alpha Natural Resources, and some of the others that in that kind of coal space will do well. Now, there's two types of coal. There's the coal that's used to heat things, just the heating types of coal where you're going to use it in maybe, as opposed to a heating oil or maybe natural gas. And this is the coal that's the metallurgical, which is used in the creation of things like steel and all that. And that's a basic description. But the point is that, when we look at these, and sometimes when we see things that have been falling for such a long time, there is an opportunity. Now, you don't want to go out there and catch a falling knife ever, but at the same time, maybe there's an opportunity for one of these to start moving if we do see some of the negative sentiment really get to a point of really, really high levels. And then you get that capitulation selling, that high volume capitulation selling on the downside. And that often looks like if you could see a basing from there, there may be an opportunity to get in on something for, at least if nothing else, a little pop on the upside. But we have to talk about that, and of course, there are other companies. We really need to focus on a few things. First of all, clearly the topic and focus, and something that I have been right and wrong with, more wrong than right, is the whole yen discussion. The Bank of Japan last week came out with a massive amount of monetary stimulus in the form of purchase of bonds and weakening of the currency, the yen, and they also are going in directly and purchasing REITs, and they're also purchasing other stocks in their stock market. They're also going to look to double their monetary base by 2014. In other words, what they're doing is above and beyond what even the most aggressive policy was expected to be. Now, the big question is why? Well, first of all, they had to do something because they're in a deflationary spiral with an aging population. And what happens here is that if they don't do something, they're going to pretty much be in this situation for a very long time. Lack of competitiveness for their companies that do a lot of exporting, their automobile sector, their electronics sector. And what happened over the last number of years is something they really don't want to continue because they are going to lose out to other countries that have either weaker currencies or that have really approached their level of competitiveness overall, and that's just not a good thing. So what's happened is that all the talk, the rhetoric, the blustering of the Bank of Japan and the new elected official into that role of the chairman has come to a conclusion, at least whereas we're seeing that they are going to commit to substantial amount and almost an unlimited amount of purchases and trying to weaken their currency. Now, what we saw initially was, I guess about 3-4 days into the actual decision that was expected, saw the yen strengthen again and move back, just kind of as I thought it would move back. It seemed to be a little bit hot where it was, and there was too much selling going on. Everybody was on one side of the boat, and and then when they came out with this announcement, kind of a little time went on, and then the yen started weakening substantially again, back down to the lows, and even further, the yen is at 97 and change, and that is weaker than it was prior to this announcement. And then we saw a big move on the Japanese bonds. We saw this dramatic move to the downside first, a lot of selling going on, and then all of a sudden it started picking up again. Now, there are some unintended consequences to all of this, and really, we don't know. We really don't know what the total effect of this is going to be long term, because this experiment, which it really is an experiment, has not been tried at this level ever. This is absolutely, unquestionably historic. And when you start getting into this level of monetary policy, whereas you're deliberately going and trying to wreck your currency and you're trying to push down bond yields, I mean, the bond yields right now in Japan are like 0.4%. Now, what happens with something like that? Well, the insurance companies that have to use bonds in order to create income, in order to have have enough income to pay off claims and annuities and pensions, they got obliterated. Look at an Aflac, for example, who holds a lot of Japanese bonds last week. I mean, those stocks really got hurt pretty badly. Savers are in big trouble. Savers that have money in the banks or in guaranteed accounts or in GICs or annuities have really no recourse here. What are they going to do? So what are there's only one answer. They're pushing you into stocks. They're pushing you into alternative investments. They're pushing you into commodities. They're pushing you into anything but safe, guaranteed investments that are either government-backed or that are backed by the banks. And that's kind of not a good thing, because the savers, the income, the elderly who rely on income, the income receivers from these safe investments really get hurt. But the decision that we have here in the United States, that they did in Japan, to actually go that route, the hope is that it will turn around full circle eventually, because there is no other tools available, because fiscal policy just is non-existent, or there's nothing that can be done. The governments need the revenue from the taxes in order to pay the bondholders, and they can't cut that back dramatically. And Japan is the number one debtor in the world. Now they're going to be even a higher level, because they're going to be buying their bonds at an incredible level for some time. The question is going to be, are the bond vigilantes going to be fed up and say, you know what? There's not much more room to the upside here for these bonds. Think about it. You know, bonds can't go, they could go negative, but they're really not going to, because there's other alternatives out there. Where you can get a U.S. 10-year in the, let's just take a range, anywhere from 1.7 to 2%, let's say, depending on the time and all. Why would you go for a 0.45 or a 0.3? Is it going to move down to 0.2, 0.1? Who is going to actually keep a hold of those? I mean, the government will. They're going to keep on buying to keep rates down, to really try to stoke this whole inflation discussion that they have. They want to bring inflation to about 2%. But what about their neighbors? What about Korea, South Korea? What about Taiwan? These are neighbors that do a lot of exporting and are really going to feel the brunt of this, because Japan now has given themselves an unbelievable advantage by deliberately trashing their own currency in the name of helping their exports and helping, inflation. And when they are going and actively doing this, what happens is the other currencies are rising potentially, and their products are less competitive. Well, next thing that happens is they start throwing tariffs on Japanese products. Already we saw many companies increasing prices on their products inside of Japan to keep pace with the lack of the currency valuation. And you have to wonder, how are the Japanese going to deal with that? You know, the Japanese now have the value of their yen and they're going to be seeing increases in prices. That's not really great. That doesn't really help those companies that are outside of Japan selling there. Look at, we talked about Caterpillar ad nauseum for the last several weeks. We actually closed our position for a nice profit on that. But Caterpillar clearly could see some further downside if this yen keeps on moving to the, you know, lower and lower and lower. The U.S. currency, dollar, even though on Friday had a pretty negative day because of the jobs number, we saw 88,000 on the print for jobs number, even though we saw a 7.6% unemployment rate. We'll get to that in a second. But the U.S. currency moved down, and that was really didn't affect the yen at all. But what it did affect was the euro. The euro popped by about 70 basis points. Because nobody really wants to go and start taking their money and buying Japanese yen on an offset on a spot basis. So what they're going to do is they're going to find other outlets. So what happens is think of a water balloon when you squeeze it, right? You never know where that the balloon's going to pop out of your fingers. Something's going to squeeze out somewhere, and that's what's happening here. So you get this unintended consequence of this movement that things happen. So if the euro goes higher, that's not good either for the Europeans, because if the yen's going lower against it, they can't buy their products as readily. So not only do we have this unintended consequences, we have what's called collateral damage. And you know what? I think some countries are going to get pretty feisty about this situation. They kept their mouth shut recently at the G20 meeting. I really wonder if they're going to keep their mouth shut any longer. Already China has started to, to swaddle their feathers a little bit and kind of talk about how they're really concerned about this. Korea is really pissed off, South Korea, that is. North Korea is pissed off of the world, so, they're going to be nuking everybody, it looks like, and that's just a whole ridiculous discussion in of itself. But, when we look at the overall dynamic right now of what's happening around the world, you have to call it protectionism. There's no two ways about it. Now, is it bad? Is it good? I mean, in the short term, it's kind of good because you can kind of squeak into different markets and different places and play it. But what happens in the longer kind of picture here? Does Japan just start gobbling up all of the exports out there and really sucking everybody dry? Do we get sanctions against Japan from other countries and therefore kind of equalizing the situation? These are kind of things that we're going to see happening. And it really is something that we have to pay attention to. It's really not a funny situation, because this is beyond the level and the scope of something that really can be measured, can be planned for, and can be projected. And there's just, I think, nothing that anybody can do right now, because they don't even know in Japan if this is going to work and how much effect it's going to have on things. I wanted to also talk about North Korea just for a second here. We'll talk about earnings season and some of the bird flu situation in a moment. But, North Korea now is officially, the army has said that they have approved a nuclear strike on the United States. They've also said that they want to clear out their embassies of certain people and Russia and all that. And they have direct threats against South Korea. South Korea is kind of getting a little nervous here. China says they think that it's possible and the likelihood of some kind of a nuclear strike is possible. United States comes out with a statement last week that said, I think this was actually brilliant. I think this is really a good move. They said that they wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, North Korea did launch some missiles, because, they're saying this and they don't want to really go against them at this point. And the beauty about this and why it's so, I think, brilliantly done is it they're not challenging North Korea. What they're doing instead is saying, hey, you know what, North Korea, we know you got it. We know that you can do it. And kind of pacifying them. And I think it was a brilliant move, rather than saying something that was, would cause provocation, where they would say something like, well, North Korea, we're bigger than you. Don't screw with us. But instead, they kind of subliminally said, hey, we're okay. We know you got what you have. We know you can do this. And we're not going to fight you on this, by saying we wouldn't be surprised if North Korea would launch some missiles. It was very, very vague, but yet at the same time, I think very eloquently done. And so that was a good thing. But where are they? Where is the whole situation with North Korea? I don't know. But you know what? They want to seat at the table as a nuclear power. They want to show their strength. They want to get back and revenge everything against North Korea that happened to them. So this is going to be a kind of thorn in the side for some time. And we have to pay attention to this, especially from, you know, the Korean standpoint and Asia. All right, so that's far away from us. What's closer to home? Well, we have earnings season that will be picking up, and that starts on Monday. Alcoa is out after the close on Monday. We're also going to see things like J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo. A lot of companies reporting tomorrow, next week, but only about eight that are in the S&P 500. So this is going to start, and then we're going to see the next week come in a lot more stocks, and then it's going to start flowing dramatically. The big question is whether or not the analysts have properly put their estimates for what the guidance has been. You know, when you're looking at what is expected, revenues are slowing. That's the expectation. Earnings may be negative compared to what it was last quarter, ex-financials. And the big issue is what's going to happen as we're seeing the yield curve kind of, you know, come down a bit, and all the different things that happened with the banks and the big run-up that they had, and the massive move we saw, an expectation of a very good quarter coming out, where banks were really kind of moving the last quarter or so. Now, they didn't do as well in the first quarter on a total basis, if you look at just the financials, but they have been, you know, you pick some of the big money center banks, they've been doing pretty well. So this is going to be coming next week, and this is going to really shape the markets. Right now, we are in a very interesting consolidation phase. We see one day up. Really, last week truly was one day up, one day down over the five-day week. And we saw on Friday, as a matter of fact, a very interesting move, because after the unemployment numbers came out, which were, again, 88,000 of ads when the expectations were somewhere about 190, the expectation of the unemployment rate was 7.7, it was 7.6, but realized that the labor participation rate dipped down very hard to a multi-year, multi-decade low, which means that people have left the workforce. When you put that into the equation, well, you really have to back it out to say, okay, well, what would it have been? What would the unemployment rate have been if the labor participation rate was the same as it was, let's say, 5 years ago? Well, we're talking about 10.2%. So, you know, the statistics can kind of twist things around and move things around in a very strange way. You have to realize that when we're looking at that, first of all, the headline number will get a lot of attention, so that's great. You know, you just look at that. Oh, unemployment moved down to 7.6 in the U.S. That's fantastic. But if you realize that it was really because of the fact that people left the workforce, which a lot of people will discount, it's extremely important to realize what the health of the economy is. So we have retail sales that are coming out next week and expectations of them to stall pretty much. We saw last week also key metrics that were soft. We saw that the ISM manufacturing and, of course, the service index came down a bit and lower than expectations. Factory orders were a little bit better, but that's neither here nor there. I don't think that was one of the real important points that were of consideration, even though markets kind of blasted up on Tuesday because of that. And in fact, on Friday, when we saw the markets move down and kind of get down to a couple of key levels of support, in the last 30 minutes, everybody decided, well, it's not going any lower. Let's just buy in, and kind of ran the market up from down 1% to only, you know, down less than about 0.5%. And this is the kind of movement we're seeing, because even though we saw some volume come into the markets on the down days recently, there's so much potential for monetary easing and the opportunity for the Fed to come in or the Bank of Japan or whoever else is out there with a statement that nobody really wants to kind of sell. They're kind of sitting on what they have. They're adding to it. We saw that retail investors really started pouring money into the mutual fund marketplace and the equity area in the first 2 months of the year, pretty significantly, more than we saw for the last number of years. So, I mean, maybe people are finally saying, hey, I want to get in here. Two ways to look at that. One way is, hey, when the retail investor gets in, get the heck out. The second thing is, hey, you know, when the retail investor gets in, there's going to be a time, if they continue to put money in, that mutual fund managers and institutional managers will actually start building their portfolios back. And it takes some time to do that. You're not going to be buying 1 or 2 million shares of a stock at any given time. You're going to kind of phase yourself in. So consider that. Now, kind of shifting gears for a second and talking about something we've been talking about, which has been oil. if you listen to DH Unplugged and you obviously listen here, I have been really hardcore about the fact that oil was overpriced. The inventory levels didn't justify the price that was being paid for it. The dollar valuation comparison to it didn't work. And the consumption of it didn't seem to be really anything more than what has usually been. Yes, we're approaching the summertime, but you look at all the different things put together, and I was scratching my head saying, why is oil in the $97 range? Made no sense. Kind of kept on creeping up, goes down, it creeps up, goes down, it goes, and then it kept on going up. And then we get the Wednesday Department of Energy number, the DOE number that comes out at 10:30 every single Wednesday, and they saw a very significant build in inventories. They were looking for a build, but the build was much higher than was anticipated. In fact, inventories are at a multi-year high, which goes right to the discussion of fundamentals were not underpinning the price at 97. Is the fundamentals correct at 92, 89, 93? I mean, right now, if you look at fundamentally, oil should be sub 90 probably. But at the same time, we know that animal spirits and speculation has been very high with the fact that we have all this, right? Remember that bulging balloon kind of visual I gave you. We don't know where money's going to head into, what commodity are in or out of. Gold has been coming down, jumped up unbelievably on Friday. Silver's in a bear market. Copper's been coming down. Soybeans are getting just killed for a lot of different reasons. Corn is just coming down hard. Is it a consumption issue? Is it a fundamental issue or just a reallocation of assets? That's the big question. You know, I would not at all be shocked if oil made another run up to 95 from here, 92 to 95. Pretty good move, you know, $3 or so, maybe even a little bit higher. Because once something is down in this market, there are a ton of buyers that seem to be coming out of the woodwork from who knows where, buying in. And that has been, you know, some of the underpinning, again, because you have the fact that the safety net of the Fed is there. And there really is this lack of concern, complacency, if you will, for, you know, what's going on with fundamentals. That won't last for long. Fundamentals and technicals will converge eventually and come back and, you know, if you will, come back to a relational level that it makes sense, but it takes time. Sometimes it's oversold to a level that, you know, fundamentally it looks good, but the sentiment is down so low that people just won't buy anything. And then there's times that they'll buy anything. Think back to the 2000s with the internet craze where, you know, companies didn't have earnings, didn't have really a great business plan, just an idea and a web page, and bam, they go public and stock moves up dramatically. So I want to give you some ideas before we get to our guest of something that you may want to think about. You know, we see that there's a new strain of bird flu out in China, and that's a very serious situation because the amount of people that live there, 1.3 billion, and the fact that many of them live in close proximity and in some of the outlying areas, maybe they don't have the markets don't have the same, let's say, refrigeration and quality control. I've been there, and this is fact. They don't have the same kind of level. I mean, you can walk through some of these markets, and you can get sick to your stomach at the smell because they have meat rotting. They just leave the meat out, you know, and what happens is they get warm throughout the day, and, you know, they sell it or whatever it is. I mean, it's very noticeable that you see flies on it. You see drippings on the floor. They don't really care about a lot of the, you know, scrub down and, you know, like we have here. I mean, here you go to some of these factories and manufacturing and food processing plants. I mean, what happens is you walk in and a spray goes down, a disinfectant spray goes down that hits your shoes. And as you walk through different areas, it will keep on doing that. There's some areas that are off limits to certain people without certain clothing on and caps and shoe boots, if you will, booties, if you will, that are sterilized. And it's very serious in terms of the cleanup with boiling hot waters and various disinfectants. And that's not at all the situation in many other countries around the world. So when you see that there's this bird flu and they do a culling of 20 or 30,000 pigeons and birds, and there's a big concern that you see an outbreak of 9 or 10 of this new virus strain that's a little bit more pungent than some of the older ones, the H1N1, and you have this new H9, I don't remember the numbers. But what happens is there's really an alert that goes out because they get very concerned because of not only the amount of people there, but again, the proximity of people there, that if it does in fact start spreading human to human, you got a big problem. Now, so far, they haven't had that, supposedly. There hasn't been any human to human spread of this, but people die so quickly of it, you really don't know what's going on and where it's from. So with that, you have to look at, and this may be a little twisted, but you have to look at, okay, where are the opportunities maybe, where what's going to work, and maybe some of these flu companies that have either potential drugs for flu or that are actively involved in this particular science of, you know, beating down the flu virus. So let me give you, I'm going to give you four different names, and I want you just to put them on your radar. So we have BioCryst Pharmaceutical, and they have some things that are going on, good and bad, inside the company. But if you look at it, BRCX is the symbol. I'll put all these symbols on the Disciplined Investor website on the show notes for this particular episode. They popped, I think, 25% on Friday as some of these stocks started moving with the realization that there is an issue there. And it's a low price stock, and it's obviously very speculative. But they do potentially have some of the ingredients necessary if they get approved for the flu, et cetera. There's Dynavox, DVAX, GlaxoSmithKline, GSK. This is a company that's actively involved in the flu area. They didn't do so well on Friday. They're a big company, so there may not be a big influence on their stock due to this until something really big happens. They see big orders, et cetera. Then there's Sinovac, SVA. Sinovac is, we actually picked up BioCryst and Sinovac in the early morning on Friday, sold BioCryst for about, about an 18% gain on that day. We may look to buy it back. But Sinovac also is related in this area, and it's looked as one of the quote-unquote bird flu type of stocks. And, you know, you may want to look at that and see what, if there's an opportunity there. And, you know, you have to be quick with these in terms of, you know, you don't want to stay in these forever. News comes out that they've defeated this, or there's nothing else going on. Obviously, they can go down very quickly, but as the buildup of this thing happens, and if it does, in fact, start increasing, and we see more news items about this, there'll be more people that'll be very interested, especially with this low cost, low float type of stock. So the BCRX and the Sinovac. So just take a look at that. Nothing major, but just I want you to look at that and see what's going on. Let's get to our guest before we do that, and then we're going to talk about the KRI index and where we are with the key reversal index, because that's very important. We're going to have, Sunday night, something on it. We post these, of course, on Sunday night late, and you have the opportunity to listen to them throughout the next week, so you have good information there. But let's talk about GoToMeeting real quickly, because they are sponsoring this show, and they are great, just a fabulous, fabulous service, because they make it easy, and that's what I like. Because you can have this, you know, meeting online, and sometimes really clunky. GoToMeeting makes it really easy. They have the ability to share information and look at the other person when you're talking to them to kind of maybe figure out if you're doing a sales meeting, if they flinch, if they kind of have a little bit of a tell. But what's great about them is that they make it so easy to really deal with. In fact, you can actually get a trial of this and see for yourself, because with GoToMeeting, it's available for your iPad, your computer, your Mac, your PC, wherever you are, wherever it is, and it's free for 30 days. Very easy. Go to GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST, and you'll get 30 days of absolutely free use. You know what they say, meeting is believing. And when you have these meetings and you see how easy it is, you're going to save yourself a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of aggravation, and you're just going to love it, because we use it and we really enjoy it, because, it, you know, I work with people all around the world, and makes our life really easy, and that's important. How about we talk to Amy Smith? I want to ask her about some of the things. She always just brings us great stocks and some ideas. So, and one of the things I want to mention before we bring her on is that there was a couple of emails that came out the last few weeks, and somebody said, hey, Andrew, why don't you go look for somebody that's really bullish? Because you seem to really be bringing on all these negative people and this and that. I don't screen the people if they're bullish or bearish beforehand. We just bring on good guests with good information. And if I did, in fact, screen people and try to bring them on for certain views, let's say, that would be a slant to the whole program. And the whole idea of what we're trying to do is be just a place where we can bring out good information that's unbiased, that is at least looking at the information that's at hand, trying to review it for educational and investment purposes and figure out, hey, what's going on here? And that's why I think we all enjoy this kind of format. So we're not going to go to the level of saying we're either, you know, left or right, or political or not political, or bullish all the time, bearish or this. It's not happening here. So what the guest brings is what the guest brings. So I want to make that very clear, and hopefully you enjoy it that way. Okay, enough said. Enough said. Let's move on. Hey, with us today, Amy Smith, market commentator for Investor's Business Daily. We've had her on many times before, and the reason why we have her on is because she's great. Amy, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. How's everything with you?
Everything's great, except my confusion over some of the things that are happening, and hopefully you're going to be able to clear some of that up, because there seems to be a very, first of all, there's some argument from many of the soothsayers and pundits out there about, okay, where is the market going? Although most of them are on the side of it's, you know, bullish, which we usually see. And at the same time, you know, we're seeing that a lot of stocks have done very well through the first quarter or so. And I kind of want to get your take on that, because I know that according to IBD, there's been an uptrend for a while. Now, we look back and we see that the uptrend, there was a mini correction in there on the end of February. And then we went back to an uptrend, according to IBD. I thought I'd talk to you about, you know, historical lengths of uptrends, you know, how they kind of play out. And, you know, they're usually longer than corrections. But is this a 2 or 3 month period, a 4 month period, a lengthy uptrend? Or where does it sit in the big picture of uptrends?
This would be fairly typical. But, you know, it is a good idea to back up and take a look at where we are. And you're right, we're 19 weeks into this. It would not be unusual at this point to get a little bit of a pullback. Of course, we never want to predict, because you and I were talking before we went on air here that it's been a tricky time period. We've had the Fed pumping money into the market, and so the game has changed a little bit because of that. You've had a lot of liquidity, and there's not many places for people to put their money other than the stock market. They're not putting them in bonds, obviously. So that's held up the market as well. Now, we've seen more heavy selling come into all the indexes. We have 5 distribution days or heavy days of selling on the NASDAQ and on the S&P. So that's, you know what, that's getting a little heavy when we see these cluster of selling days come into the market. It makes us think that you'd be a little bit cautious.
You know, and it's interesting because some of the old rules, you know, let's take some of them. For example, dollar up, gold down, or, you know, dollar down, good for equity assets. Equity,
that's right.
You know,
that's right.
And let's say, for example, looking at, for example, the relationship, of bonds. Look at bonds. You know, bonds are, you know, bonds being sold, stocks being bought. Again, mm-hmm. old kind of, you know, rule of thumb kind of ideas.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
What happened?
That's classic in what happens. And I think that, you know, this week we saw a little bit of an uptick in the bond market when the market sold off and the leaders sold off, and that's what happens. I mean, money has to go somewhere. It's either going to go into the stock market or it's going to go into bonds. You and I have talked a little bit about the currencies. And, you know, money will flow somewhere because the professional investor needs to try to make some money. So it's just a matter of where is the money going. Is it a risk trade? If it's a risk trade and growth stocks are moving, then the money is in the stock market.
But at the same time, and I hear you on this, and it could be for a day, a week, or however long, we've seen also recently bonds being bought and stocks being bought.
And that is a divergence that won't last forever. You're absolutely right. So when we see that, you're going to get a break one way or the other. Something's going to give. It's unlikely that that's going to continue. So the big question is, will the market pull back and will money go into bonds then, which is, you know, considered to be, you know, a safer, less risky asset, or will money continue to go into the stock market?
And actually, it's interesting because here's another side of it. How about the fact that there's so much damn money floating around because things like the Fed have done, and maybe even Europe, but particularly what Japan has just done, that what happens is that you get just so much money that it can't be all stuffed into the same place. So they just buy every single thing out there. Seriously. I mean, how do you have days where they're buying stocks and buying bonds and they're buying the gold and they're buying the oil and I mean, you know, what, how does it all work?
You know what? I try to keep it simple. But you're right. This is a very unusual time period for this much money to have been pumped. The liquidity is just, you know, Bernanke has definitely caused a lot of money to come into the market. But I'm just going to keep my eye on what the major indexes are doing. Mm-hmm. Let's just see what they do, right? Just keep it simple.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, the IBD's big picture column, they do a very good job of, you know, just day to day, what is the market doing? And then I'm just going to take a look at a basket of leaders. And I'm going to say, okay, these are the leading stocks that I've identified. They've been doing well in the market. How are they doing right now? Are they being sold? Are they kind of moving sideways and not making any gains? Or are they being sold off? And so we're going to track and take a look at what the professional investor's doing, and we'll just take a look at it day to day.
So let's go to the discussion of Summit Leaders, because a lot of that has really switched around a bit. I mean, you know, you think of a leading stock, right? What do you think of? Well, we got Apple in history, right? Yeah, Apple and the IBMs, and you have, you know, Microsoft one time. So you got a lot of tech was always kind of leading, right? Well, these days, healthcare is on fire.
It is, and some of the unusual things you wouldn't think, the hospitals, some of the hospitals have done well because with Obamacare, they're supposed to get a rise in the people that will go. They'll actually go to the emergency room because they know now that they can get treated and it'll be paid for. So some of the hospital and the healthcare stocks have done well as a result. I'll tell you what, in the most recent uptrend, that we were all over the place, though. We had industry groups that were working across the board. We had, you know, the home builders were doing well. We had pharmaceuticals that were doing well. We had travel and leisure stocks that were doing well because people, there was an uptick in travel. You know, we had Alaska Air, and, you know, that zoomed up higher because people were, you know, doing more traveling, buying more plane tickets, going places, home away. That's another one. This is a vacation rental specialty, and they have homes all over the world that people can go rent for vacations. And that stock in the most recent quarter had earnings that were up 100%. So these are the stocks. They were really, when you see a broad-based rally like that, that was a good sign that the market was acting strong because the gains were from many, many different sectors, many different industry groups.
But still, many of the, as you mentioned, let's just start with this. You mentioned things that you wouldn't think would do well. So you say the HMOs. By the way, last week there was some really weird action, or maybe it was earlier this week. There's some really weird action in the HMO stocks, you know, where you had, for example, a couple of them at about 3-ish in the afternoon start popping up dramatically, like, you know, 8%. And we knew there was going to be some kind of a decision made after the close on the Medicare reimbursements, and there was already on plan to have a cut of 2% and some doctor repayment billings cut. And lo and behold, after the close, and about a half hour later, they came out, and instead of the 2% cut, they went with, I think, a 3% increase. So Humana and UNH, they kind of zoomed, which is really kind of fascinating because it kind of flies right in the face of trying to save money, but we'll get into that another time. But but it's interesting that, yeah, I agree that at first of all, these stocks have not done well in the last quarter.
Yes, that's a good thing also. You know, well, it's news driven. It's, you know, what are things going to be changed with Obamacare? Are things going to stay the same? Those, I would try to stay out of the prediction there. You're right. They pop on news, very news driven. I'm going to try to shy away from some of those. You know, I'd rather go with something that I can see has some good, strong earnings and that's not going to be as affected by news.
Right, exactly. But we had that was leading, doing very, you know, we have maybe some of the healthcare that's done well overall, you know, an aging population makes a lot of sense and all. We've had, for example, the other thing that was incredible, I think a lot of people scratched their heads about this, is the defense sector.
Well,
what
that's
is that?
True.
What is that about? you know, that flies in the face of any kind of reasonable thought.
It does, particularly because President Obama was going to cut defense spending. So, well, that just showed you, I think, actually, that all across the board, that the market, the stocks in all different groups were doing very, very well. Now, you know, nothing goes up forever. And, you know, this past week there was some selling. You know, home builders had been doing very, very well, but you're seeing a little bit of a sell-off in some of those. There may be some sector rotation there. You know, you saw the stocks that I just mentioned, you know, Alaska Air and HomeAway. A lot of these stocks did go through a little bit of a pullback this week. We don't know. Will they bounce back? Will the leadership change? Will we get some sector rotation? We're just going to keep looking at our screens here, you know, the IBD 50, your weekly review. We'll just see what happens in the market over the next couple of days.
No. And actually, I think that if you remember last Monday, the market was down for a variety of reasons. And I figured out the reason why Tuesday it zoomed up, even on, you know, it was factory orders were up 3%. It was revised. It met expectations. I think the bulls were just pissed off that that it was down. And you're not in 2013. I don't know if you saw that on page 14 of the SEC manual, that you're not allowed to have markets down in 2013 on any day, and especially consecutive days.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens with that. I mean, we'll see.
Yeah. So let's talk about a couple other things, you know, that, you know, one of the things that I've always, I kind of, in these market conditions, well, not these, last couple of years, 3 years, whatever, and especially with the growth names that you track, mm-hmm. it's interesting to me that I get how if you're in an uptrend, well, you know, generally stocks will, you know, follow along, even the crappy
sure.
ones and all that.
Sure, yeah.
And you buy it at a reasonable time and all, you know, at the right point and the breakout points and all that. Okay. And then you go and say that, well, you want to make sure to sell a stock with a stop loss of about 7 to 8%, give or take. Now, when you have a growth stock that's a Momo stock, it's moving, right?
Yeah.
And let's say it does break out and all that. I mean, 7 or 8%, it sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot in the, you know, if you have a couple of days of a correction in markets and just moving down with any of these stocks.
And 7 and 8%, you're right. You can get there very quickly. It's just a nice place. It's a way to protect your portfolio. Bill O'Neill, the founder and chairman of IBD, you know, he's just done a lot of market studies. And basically, you know, Bernard Baruch, all the legendary traders, you know, really said the same thing. If you keep your losses small, then you let your winners run, and that's how you really make a lot of headway in mm-hmm. the market. So it's just sort of a place where you say, hey, you know what? I am not going to let my stock go in below 7 to 8% what I paid for it. I have no questions asked. I'm going to sell. I'm going to get out. And, you know, of course, what happens? Sure, the stock will sometimes turn around and go back up on you. But you know what? That way you've protected yourself. Because what if it goes down 10%, then 20%?
Right.
And then you say, then you start to justify it. Then you say, well, I can't sell now. You know, I need to hold on to it a little bit longer to see if I can, if it'll come back on me. So, you know, just think about selling it, and then you can always buy a stock back if it turns around and it goes back up again.
Yeah, because, I mean, there is the other side. Let's call them the value players, or let's, you know, or a different kind of player.
Okay.
Who is not looking for breakouts right above a certain resistance point and all that. They'd rather buy on support.
Okay.
That's a different way of doing things. I mean, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it is. I mean, you hear all the time, you know, you watch TV, waiting for a pullback, and then we're going to buy, right? And I find that really interesting because in the last, number of months, I've noticed that stocks do pull back, and they get to a point that you would think of if you look at any kind of technical analysis, not every stock, but just certain situations, that it should be breaking down from there, right? It should kind of start rolling over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like miracle of miracles, you get an upgrade right then and there, or you get
right.
somebody holding, somebody all of a sudden coming in and propping it up and it's like, you know, and buying it and for whatever reason, and it just never gets to that point. Now, there are those that happen, don't get me wrong, but I find it really interesting that it's like almost like the 50-day moving average catch.
Yeah, sure, sure. And that, you know what, that's a great place too. We do sometimes buy as a stock will come off of the 50-day. That's a place where you can if it bounces off that with some volume. But you're right. The institutional investor, if they're going to come in, if they're going to support the position that they may have in a company, when it comes down to that level, that's a good benchmark place where they may come in and support the stock. But I think, you know what, even the value player can take a look at a price consolidation, if you don't want to call it a base. It's, you know, just an area where the stock is getting support. And if you find that it's holding support at a certain level, that's always a good thing.
Right.
Because, you know, then we'll see if it makes a move up. And usually the stock, you know, what's going to propel a stock higher, it's usually these fabulous earnings. Is the company doing something right? Do they have something new? Do they have anything innovative? Is the consumer buying their product? Chipotle Mexican Grill. I had a friend that was it was near his law firm in New York City, and when Chipotle was first, you know, really first getting started out, he said there were lines out the
mm-hmm.
door, you know, like
mm-hmm.
45 minutes. So when you see that kind of a company, and then you went in, I remember talking to Bill about this, and he said, it was just a burrito. But then you went in, he said, no, it's different. This is different than Taco Bell. You know, they have fresh food. It was organic. It was made the way you wanted it. You could, it was tasty, and it was not very expensive. And so, of course, you know, their earnings went through the roof. So those are the kind of companies that we're going to look for, those really new, innovative companies.
So if we're thinking about lines at restaurants, and that
yeah.
using that as a kind of a tool to see if, in fact, there's something that may be there. Cracker Barrel. There's always a line there.
Okay.
And I have no idea why. Have you ever seen a Cracker Barrel?
I've never eaten at a Cracker Barrel.
You can't eat really at a Cracker Barrel. Nobody gets in because the lines are so long.
Okay. All
you
right.
Know?
Well, they must be doing something right.
I think what they do, and this is a great plan, is they make it so that you wait like on the porch that they have there so it looks like they're really busy.
Okay.
I'm not kidding. I'm serious.
Well, that could be a marketing strategy. Yeah. Absolutely.
We have a place down here that they put the parking lot kind of in the front so that when you go there, it always looks busy.
Oh, it always looks very, very busy. Yeah, right. You know what? And Costco is like that. When you go to Costco here in L.A., you know, you cannot park anywhere. It's just always, always packed. But those are companies, you know, obviously people are using their products. And as you say, they're eating at the Cracker Barrel. So, yeah, I would look for a company that's bringing in the numbers.
Yeah. And actually, I'll tell you a quick story, if I may. Brilliant story, a pharmacist who actually opened up a big chain eventually. But one of his things that he did when he had his first pharmacy was, in Florida, you have to kind of use the Florida as the backdrop for this, is that he would put tuna fish cans, I'm not kidding, on sale at the pharmacy counter in the back. So when all these people walked in all the time, they're like, whoa, look how busy this pharmacy is, and they're buying all this stuff. Well, he put, you know, all these elderly people would be buying tuna fish in cans at reduced prices, and it made it look like the whole pharmacy was really busy. I'm not kidding about this either. And it just, I guess his thing just took off. I don't know if he kept using the tuna fish cans, but seriously, that's a true story.
That's, you know what, look how clever that is. That's very clever marketing. He was doing it probably for not very much money, buying these cans of tuna, and it made his business look like it was busy all the time. But, you know, these are the companies. I'll tell you something else. I did a presentation, one of my favorite ones that I do, was on how to find the next super stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I take a look at them, and you mentioned Google before we came on air, Baidu, which is the Google of China, Priceline made a 1,000% move in the bull market that started in March 2009. What do they have in common? And one factor is that the masses of people can go use their goods or services. You think about Netflix. You know, we were in a recession, and here's Netflix. You could stay home. You had no late fees the way you did with Blockbuster. Very inexpensive. You just stick it in your mailbox. You get a movie, you know, back and forth. So a lot of people were using Netflix. The same with all of the super stocks. It's something that the masses of people can use. It's not too expensive, but it's in big, big demand.
Right, and especially new things. And you know, it's funny. I think it's really interesting that there's a Peter Lynch kind of concept, but what people can do is think about what you love. You know, what is it that you, I mean, maybe your first Apple, you're like, man, this is a great machine. You got to kind of think through that for a second and think, okay, well, where can I possibly, you know, where is this going and what's the company and, you know, is there an opportunity there?
Yeah.
I love my Lazy Boy.
You know what? And I'll tell you, that's how I actually really got to know more about Lululemon. There was one in Beverly Hills. They had a very smart marketing idea. You could go take a free yoga class, and they would move all of the yoga clothes off of the floor, right? You do your yoga class, and then what they did, they would have fruit and all kinds of little snacks afterwards, and they would wheel the clothes back into the middle of the store. And so, of course, you know what I did. You end up buying some product, because you say, oh, those yoga pants are so cute. And then, you know, of course, I go study the chart, and I'm looking at the earnings and the fundamentals and all of that. It's a great way, if you want to get to know a company, go in it, see what they're like, see what the store is like, what is the customer service like, are they really doing good customer service? Now, Alaska Airlines, you know, I mentioned that one, I went to their website, I was like, okay, this company looks interesting, it was setting up for a run, Travel and Leisure was doing well, what makes Alaska Air unique? So I went to the company website, they had the best on-time record for 3 years in a row, 87% they're on time, and they gave their employees an $88 million bonus in 2012.
Wow.
Equal to 1 month's pay for their 13,000 employees. So they were managing their money so well, they were giving their employees this huge bonus.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. That would be nice to work for that company,
no
right?
Kidding.
That's great. Yeah.
But I got to tell you something. I really appreciate the new level of transparency at Lululemon.
You know what? Every man that I've talked to, you know.
I'm talking about the corporate transparency. What were you thinking?
I was thinking of the see-through pants that they had. I mentioned that to my husband, and he said, they had to, you know, recall all these pants because they were see-through. And he said, what's wrong with that?
What's the problem? I don't see the problem. Think about how many more men would be in the gym at this point.
That's right.
It's good for the health of the nation.
That's the same thing my radio show co-host Matt said. He's like, hey, what's the problem?
Yeah, what's the problem?
You know, actually, the woman lost her job that was in charge of she resigned. That was in charge of product.
I'm not going to feel bad. That was a disaster. Come on, should I feel bad for her?
Was what?
So I'm not going to feel bad for her. It was a disaster.
Well, it was very costly for the company.
Yeah, of course.
Also. Yeah,
of course.
Very, very costly. Yeah.
So I just want to get back to a few things because there's a, you know, by the way, HomeAway, just as a mention of HomeAway, and I'll put all these symbols on the show notes for this week, but HomeAway, I actually use them. I have a rental property. There's two different companies that are out there that we use and very well frequented, and we get all of our rentals, renters from HomeAway and this other company, and they're very good.
And that's interesting. So you actually will advertise the property that you own on HomeAway?
Yep.
Okay, very, very good.
It's very cheap. It's very good. They get, you know, the contracts are right there. We send it. It's all email, and they, you know, use the lake house that we have. I want to talk about, you know, you brought this up last time too, and I keep on, I'm having this, like, this problem. And I'm not saying the stock isn't a good stock and all that. It just, it reminds me of something. Is SodaStream.
Oh, yeah, soda. Okay.
And I get the point. I mean, you make your own soda and you save money and it's fun, I guess.
And it's supposed to be green, you know, it's supposed to be, I think they're, you know, in their ads, they say, join the revolution and, you know, get rid of cans and bottles. And they have an interesting concept. I haven't tried it. They have 60 different flavors. I think one thing, this company's pretty smart. Now, it doesn't mean that the stock is going to, you know, definitely make a huge run, but they had ads in the Super Bowl, so they wanted to get a big exposure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then they have their product in a lot of these big retailers. They've got it in Costco, Target, Walmart, and Best Buy. So they're trying. They're really trying to position themselves to sell a lot of their little products.
Right.
I have a friend. I don't know. She likes them. I've never tried it. Do you know anyone that owns one of their machines?
I did, and I've seen it. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's a Green Mountain coffee.
It's Gillette.
It's Gillette. It's the same concept.
Same thing.
You buy the machine, and then you buy the stuff that you put in all that. Well, but during the Super Bowl, one of the things, you know, they were not allowed to use one of their actual ads because I guess they were dissing the other guys. But, you know, the stock has been doing well. It's an Israeli firm, and I just find it to be, I guess maybe ride the wave till it, you know, blows up on you because, if it blows up on you, because I see Green Mountain written all over this thing. It could,
you know, there's no guarantee here that it's going to do particularly well. You know, it's one of those things. I think again, you're going to have to wait and see how the earnings do. If they can keep, they've had some pretty good double-digit earnings numbers, and they're due out with their earnings May the 6th. So at that point, I don't know. Maybe we're going to get a better idea if all of the heavy-duty work that they did. So they paid a lot of money for those ads in the Super Bowl. It cost them a pretty penny, and they've spent a lot of money trying to get their, you know, their product positioned in all these big retailers. So now it's just going to be a question, does this catch on? Do people want to buy these machines? I was kind of, to be honest with you, I was surprised that Green Mountain did as well as it did until, I think this was like 2009. I was staying in a hotel, and there was one in the hotel room, and I said, you know, this is not bad coffee. This is pretty good. And then I kind of got it. Like, okay, you can take this to work. You can have a gourmet cup of coffee made the way you want it, or a nice cup of tea, instead of that, you know, that coffee that's been on the pot in the office for 5 hours that tastes horrible. So I kind of got the popularity. And then, you know what, when Green Mountain Coffee Roasters put their product in Walmart right before Mother's Day, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And then they zoomed up on earnings as a result. That's the kind of thing that causes, you know, these stocks to zoom higher. So I don't know if SodaStream will have the same popularity. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Now, a company, you mentioned a couple others that you want. We have on the list here, Protolabs, which is a company that based, electronic company, but basically, or tech company. It's in a consolidation you mentioned here, and they do these custom parts for creating virtual images, which can then be put into 3D printers. Now, the 3D printer space has recently been very volatile.
Yes, it certainly has been, and this is the only one really. This one has also pulled back some, so this is not in a place you want to buy it right now. But it has an interesting concept. It's a little bit different than the other 3D printers, and it's exactly what you just said. That what they do for a company is you come in and you say, I want to make this widget. Okay, so they create the virtual image, right? And then you take a look at it, and they design it, and you go back and forth. Okay, I like the widget the way you've done it. Take that virtual image, put it into 3D printer, and I now have my unique little product. Now, their earnings have accelerated for 4 quarters. They were at 15%, then they went to 26%, 32%. 6 weeks ago, they reported earnings that were up 121%. So, you know, it's a company that has seen some growth. Again, we'll have to wait and see how they report in the next time. But Interesting concept. I don't. The whole idea that you can make something. You know, for the James Bond movies, mm-hmm. they made a 3D version of the Aston Martin so that nice. They wouldn't have to blow up the real Aston Martin.
Yeah, that would be sad.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's awesome. But you know, at the same time, Protolabs has been probably riding on the coattails of the 3D printer craze, if you will.
Sure. So, oh, yes, absolutely.
You know, because right now the 3D printing, there's some very big machines out there. You know, Stratasys and
3D
has, you know, the market on this, although I think IBM may have something there too, Lexmark, a little bit, something. But these are the main guys, the main two guys.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they're obviously riding the coattails of that becoming more popular in not only the personal space, but also in the industrial and commercial space.
That's right.
Now, TripAdvisor, you mentioned, this is interesting. I just happened to be in Costa Rica last week, and we're looking for restaurants. And what was really cool, we always use TripAdvisor to find out things and all, and what was interesting was that I was looking for a restaurant. What I really thought was cool was that that particular night, I was looking for a restaurant. And what I found was that there was reviews from that night that I was reading. You follow what I'm saying? So it was like a really fresh review of what I was saying. But the question is, how do they make money? Is it all ads?
Yes, that's primarily the way they're making money. Now, their earnings numbers are a little bit better than Expedia and Kayak. And you know what? What you just said... this is the Amy question. So I went around to ask everybody, you know, what website do you use if you're going to find travel-related content? And everybody did exactly the same thing that you just said. They go, I go to TripAdvisor. And mm-hmm. I said, well, why? Why do you go to TripAdvisor? And they said, well, I read the reviews. Mm-hmm. I always take a look at the reviews, and they take a look at the restaurants. And, you know, somebody said, well, you know, if I want to stay at a hotel, I want to go read a review of someone that stayed there. If I want to... You know, I want to take a flight. You know, what are the best prices? And so they get a lot of traffic, an awful lot of traffic for people that go and take a look at their reviews.
What's also interesting, though, is that when I was in Costa Rica, they had like TripAdvisor, like little signage at all the different places. They're really proud of the fact. As a matter of fact, when I walked into one restaurant, how'd you find us? They said, did you see us on TripAdvisor? So I guess, well, maybe this is one particular area that's really big on it. But the question is, I never bought anything on TripAdvisor, not that I'm recalling.
Well, somebody is.
But what are you buying? Can you buy flights on TripAdvisor?
Yeah, you buy flights. Oh, okay. If you go to their website, you can do flights, you can make hotel reservations, you can get vacation rentals. So they also do the vacation rentals. We were talking about HomeAway.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have incredibly stellar earnings numbers. Mm-hmm. They were up 21% in the most recent quarter. But they're just, this is a company that's just doing better than some of the competition, which is, you know, Expedia and Kayak.
Right, exactly. All right, well, that covers a lot of the things that we are talking about. Now, you mentioned that over the last several weeks there's been 4 or 5 distribution days. That happened recently, as a matter of fact.
Sure.
But it also seems that the difference right now is that there's been a rather quick recovery. This has been happening for a little while now, but a rather quick recovery, whereas... And I think in one of Bill's books, if I recall mm-hmm. correctly, uh-huh. there's a discussion about money going in and money coming out. So let me just refine that. So when a mutual fund needs to buy a position,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a hedge fund, but we'll talk about an institutional player, needs to buy a position. They're going to buy, I don't care what it is, IBM, whatever. They're not buying 5 shares. Okay.
Right.
And they're buying a lot of shares. And they're not going to do it all at once either, because then they're going to rock the market. So they may give an order, a standing order that they want to buy 50,000 shares a day for the next month at this price or something like that. Now, the opposite is true also, that when they say they want to sell, they're usually not going to sell all at once because they're going to rock the market pretty well. So they give an order, and that's where you see the distribution coming in. One of the things that I've noticed, though, is that markets are rather illiquid. When we buy securities, and we're not buying that kind of level, but you know, well, let's say we buy 5,000 or 10,000 shares or something, I got to tell you, over the last year, I have found it to be less and less liquid, and it moves much more. You got to be really careful on, you know, you don't put market orders in, but it moves, and that is just a sign of illiquidity to me. Is that an issue?
Are you saying there's not enough liquidity?
There is liquidity, but there's not that much liquidity is what I'm saying. I mean, in other words, I remember, you know, going back a number of years, you could essentially put in a block order and buy it and not really move the price too much.
Mm-hmm.
These days, you have to kind of, if you wanted to get it right now, you got to chase it a little bit. And it may only be 5 or 10 cents. But it just seems to me there's a lot less liquidity. And that may be due to some of the computer algorithms that are dealing with it. They don't show it all, and they can be fast enough to pull it and move it down away from you or something like that. But there's definitely a difference in liquidity in markets. And I think that's one of the reasons why things move up so much or down quickly, up or down quickly.
Well, I think you're probably right. It would have to do with some of the algorithms. But in terms of the individual investor, I think one way to protect yourself from any kind of a movement like that is to stay with really bigger liquid stocks. Mm-hmm. Those thinner, more volatile stocks, let's say a stock that trades 500,000 or less per day, those are going to be a little bit more volatile, and not that you can't play them and not that you can't do well, but let's say you have a portfolio, you've got five or six stocks. Maybe one is more thinly traded. Maybe you get a big cap in there that's really a very large company so that you have one of those in your portfolio to really help stabilize it. And then if someone's really afraid of that kind of volatility, just stick with a stock that's a little bit more liquid.
Yeah, I hear you. So, interesting, though. So what does the add-up have to be now for considered a quote-unquote correction?
Oh, okay. So if you get five or six distribution days in like a four to five week period of time, that's usually enough to put the market actually into a correction. That's enough of that cluster of distribution. And really, the average investor can keep up with this in the IBD big picture column every day. You can also just see it on the major indexes. If you start to see heavy selling clustered in a really fairly short period of time, that is just it tells us that the institutional investor is heading to the sidelines. And you and I talked about this, three out of four stocks are going to move with the general market, whether it's up or whether it's down. So if they do begin to sell in earnest, you don't want to be the salmon trying to swim upstream. You want to make sure to get out of the way.
Yeah, I hear you. Obviously, try to ride them in both sides, in other words.
Sure.
What they're doing and ride on both sides. But again, like I said, we have four or five you just mentioned, and it is still this wonky situation where you may have one day down, then one day up, one day down, one day up. It's kind of like almost they cancel each other out.
Well, I think what you're seeing here is you're seeing some institutional selling on one day. You can have some other institutional buyers coming in. They want to prop the market up, so they'll come in. Then we have another news. We get something out of the Eurozone, or who knows what the news is going to be. Maybe the Fed, we get the news that maybe the Fed may ease back on quantitative easing, and, of course, that sent the market lower. So there's been a little bit of a tug and a pull, but that is the indecision in the market. See, we didn't have that.
Right.
January 2nd, everything's great. The fiscal cliff was resolved, whether anyone believes that or not. The markets, liked the resolution, and we took off and we had a nice smooth move. But when you get that indecision, that's when we get the choppy market.
Yeah, and that's clearly what you could see now. Whatever that resolves to be is a different story. But the indecision is very, very clear now where, there is this kind of, this is, somebody saying, this is the end and this item is going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Or, this is a reason, that wasn't enough of a reason. North Korea, they blame. Listen, the media, with all due respect, is title happy. They got to have a sexy title that may have absolutely nothing to do with the content. Seriously. You know that.
Well, they do. Their job is actually to kind of make a story. So whatever the story of the day is, to try to get people to tune in. And, if the market shakes off the news, and if the market doesn't really care, if the stocks are ignoring the news, then you're in a good, strong uptrend. But if every little news item starts to rattle the market and everybody, unfortunately, what you've been hearing on TV is, we're going to correct. We're going to get this big, huge correction. And so I think there's already this anticipated pullback. Now, the market, as you and I both know, it's going to confound everybody. It'll do the opposite of what we expect it to do. So it doesn't mean that we're going to get a correction here. But when we do see the indecision, we get slopped around a little bit with a choppy market.
Yeah, and for example, by the way, one of the things I love doing is looking for this totally separate, but it goes with this, is looking at commitment of traders reports on things like oil or gold, whatever it may be. And I can't tell you how many times I have seen the commitment of traders report and the baseline of the summary of the article and the commitment of traders report is that hedge funds are the heaviest they've ever been and the most bullish they've been on oil. That was just last week. And I'm like, hello, you know what I'm doing? I'm going the other way.
Yeah. You're going the other way, right? Well, that happens too. When the sentiment, and when everyone is too bullish, I remember a hedge fund manager telling me, I interviewed him for the book that I wrote, and he said, you know, after 2000, people wanted to send him millions and millions of dollars. Now, we'd already topped. The market was already pulling back. All the tech titans were getting hit. They were selling off like crazy. When everybody wants to jump into the pool, that's usually about the time you want to jump out of the pool.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, hey, Amy Smith, Investors Business Daily. Go over there, and I think you can get, if you're not getting it yet, there's all sorts of little deals they have and trial periods, and not to mention, of course, the other side of the house or the other side of the company, or my friend Scott has Market Smith, of course, the wonderful charting and fundamental analysis all in one package available for your iPad and your computer and all that. Awesome, awesome package. And, of course, the great writings of Amy and the Daily Market Review. She does a video that does all sorts of nice charting with all sorts of arrows and circles and highlights and telling you what's going on.
You can find that at investors.com.
Investors.com. Hey, Amy, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Andrew. Nice being on your show.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
I just love her spirit. She's kind of very uplifting, and I enjoy her her attitude where, she's looking for great opportunities, but, kind of a little bit deeper than the big names that we know about sometimes, and brings us great opportunities. I'll put all those stocks as well on, it's going to be a long list of stocks here that we talked about on the show, on the Disciplined Investor site. And I want to make sure, by the way, that, you can get a couple ways you can get this very easily. You can either follow me on Twitter, which is Andrew Horowitz, one word, or you can actually sign up and you can get a daily summary of it right on the site. Top right, there's a little kind of box there where you can get emails that will come in a summary the day after. You get all the different things that we write about on a regular basis. Or you can just go check out the site on a regular basis at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. All right, quickly before we go, I want to mention the KRI indicator. This is the key reversal indicator. Make sure to go click on that. You'll see it on the site right now. What we've seen was really interesting lately because we have not seen a very significant amount of oversold or overbought, overheated levels through 2013 so far. In fact, there's only been a couple of times where we could really say that it's been overheated and really hasn't been tremendously oversold at any given point. In the time that we thought that was overheated, we mentioned it, I think, on the show. There was a Friday. We said, hey, you know what? We're getting really overheated here. In fact, the market did come down a little bit, but just bounced right back up and then kind of has been in a kind of up and down consolidation area for that time since. Kind of a lot of indecision, a lot of line in the sand and kind of tug and pulling, tug of war going on right now between the bulls and the bears. And what's interesting is that we're seeing that show very, very clearly in the KRI indicator, because what's happening is that we're kind of going into a little bit of an overbought and then a little bit of an oversold, and it's kind of making its way. But one of the things that we did not see recently was when we did see that that overbought and overheated condition in mid-March, we have not seen a drawdown yet that would really take care of that, kind of soak up all that excess. Now, whether or not that's going to happen is, interesting, but at this point right now, the summary, I'll give you the punchline to all of this, is that when you look at the history, you look at the recent, you look at the trend right now, what we're finding is that we are starting to slope down a little bit, and the consideration and the wager would be that the downside is more likely than the upside, according to, kind of the level of buying, selling pressure and a variety of other indicators that we use in there. It kind of lends itself to showing that, there's going to be some further downside to soak up that excess that was recently added through the first 3 months of the year, as well as the big move that we saw that really pushed the level up to about a 2, which is the biggest we've seen. Over 3 or under negative 3 are really the alert areas. A 4 is an imminent turnaround, negative 4, positive 4. But we've only seen about a 2, and that's kind of really doesn't give us a lot of absolute conviction on either side. So right now we're kind of the trend is going to continue, whatever that is, and the next leg can be either way. But again, the better bet is kind of a little bit of down. Now, I would not go out and just, blatantly, load up 100% plus leverage of a short on the markets right now. But at the same time, I don't think I'd be going super long. And if I was long, I'd be taking positions off and looking for opportunities that we could either short or, take some profits on. So that's kind of the bigger picture. But if you read that and you go through all the things that we talk about on the KRI and the charts that we put up on there and show you the history and the recent, I think you'll get the good picture of where we are on that. Anyway, we're going to end it right there. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate you coming along. Please leave a review on iTunes so we can see what you're saying about it. And of course, you can continue sending me your emails on what you think about Frank Curzio and myself doing a podcast on a weekly basis. We've already come up with some ideas. Great emails from people on names and on content and on production. We're kind of debating whether we're going to do it or not, but also whether if we do it, are we going to be live? Are we going to have guest call-ins? Are we going to have advertisers? Are we going to have listener call? I mean, who knows? So anyway, keep on sending it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and I'll keep doing what I do on a regular basis. If you want to visit us, just over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and check out triggerpointresearch.com for the commodity alerts that now trade automatically in your brokerage account if you want that. Pretty cool stuff going on there. And of course, the 14-day free trial of the equity alerts, and you should see how that performance has been doing. It's been kicking some butt. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.